You are listening to the Mental Health Download from the nonprofit Mental Health Association Oklahoma. I'm Addie McCaslin. Today I am talking with Dr. Robin Opperle, Ms. Elizabeth Aikman, and Dr. Hannah Berg. Opperle is a licensed clinical psychologist and principal investigator at Laureate Institute for Brain Research and associate professor at the University of Tulsa. Her research uses neuroimaging and behavioral measures to better understand approach avoidance decision-making and mechanisms and predictors of psychological treatment for mood, anxiety, and trauma-related disorders. Aikman is a licensed professional counselor, currently serving as lead therapist and clinical research coordinator for Dr. Opperle's treatment outcome studies at Laureate Institute for Brain Research. Her clinical training includes evidence-based interventions for anxiety, mood, and substance use disorders, with extensive training and experience in behavioral activation and exposure-based therapies. Berg is a postdoctoral research scholar at Laureate Institute for Brain Research. Her research investigates clinical anxiety from a decision-making perspective with the goal of contributing brain-based insights that improve the conceptualization and treatment of psychopathology. Her clinical training includes evidence-based interventions for anxiety, mood, eating disorders, and obsessive-compulsive disorder. I am thrilled to have all three of them on today, and I hope you find the conversation as fascinating as I did. The Mental Health Download starts now.
I can start with introductions and then we can go down the line. So I'm Robin Opperle, and I'm a licensed clinical psychologist as well as principal investigator at Laureate Institute for Brain Research and also associate professor at the University of Tulsa. So that's a mouthful, but I lead a research lab here at Laureate Institute for Brain Research, or LIBR, focused on understanding mechanisms and predictors of different therapies for anxiety, depression, and trauma-related disorders.
Thank you.
Hand it off to Hannah.
Okay. Hi, I'm Hannah Berg. I'm a postdoctoral research scholar here at LIBR. I got my PhD in clinical psychology at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities, and then came here to LIBR. I work closely with Robin on some clinical trials that we'll be talking about involving behavioral treatments for anxiety and depression. And my particular interest is in neuroimaging to understand decision-making in clinical anxiety.
Thank you.
I'm Elizabeth Aikman, and I am an LPC at LIBR, and I work in Robin's lab as a research therapist on the clinical trials that we are discussing today.
Very good. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
All right. So the three of you are co-presenters, practical and neuroscientific perspectives of behavioral therapy. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. I guess to continue our balance of going around the table. So I'll start and then Elizabeth and Hannah can fill in details as well. But with this presentation, we really wanted to strike a balance between a research-focused intervention or research-focused talk, as well as providing information that's helpful on a practical level in terms of clinical work. And so we are going to be talking about findings from a randomized clinical trial that we conducted that included neuroimaging. And so we were trying to better understand whether there may be common neural mechanisms as well as unique neural mechanisms and predictors for different behavioral therapies for depression and anxiety. And so in the clinical trial, we focused on two gold standard commonly used behavioral approaches for anxiety and depression, one being exposure-based therapy, which is focused on testing out one's expectations about negative experiences or fears, and then also behavioral activation, which is focused more on enhancing engagement and reinforcing activities. So two behavioral interventions with two very different targets, but with the same common endpoint in mind in terms of enhancing functioning, enhancing our ability to engage in the world around us in an effective way. With neuroimaging, we focused on decision-making in terms of how one makes those decisions to approach and avoid different situations that might be anxiety-provoking, but also rewarding, especially when those things are in conflict, when the same behavior may result in both. I think that's a lot of times what we face on an everyday basis, but particularly when we're feeling anxious or depressed, a lot of times we're faced with situations where we want to avoid potential negative outcomes, but by doing so, we're sacrificing potential rewards. And so we tried to look at this as potential predictors of outcomes. And in this study in particular, we were focused on generalized anxiety disorder, which often comes along with both anxiety symptoms as well as depression symptoms. So it was So with that, I'll pass it on to Hannah if she wants to share any more details about the findings and or about the interventions.
Can I ask a quick question before we, before we go further? Please. For just for the listeners out there, an everyday example, can you give an everyday example of the sort of interaction or scenario that people in the world might face and how those interventions might impact their decisions or their forward navigation?
Yes, absolutely. So actually maybe a couple different examples might be nice. So one easy example is around social situations. So a lot of us get very anxious about, say, speaking in public, for example, or speaking in front of a group. And a lot of times that anxiety can lead us to want to avoid that situation. But there's a lot of times where approaching those situations and actually engaging in that anxiety-provoking experience can be beneficial for us, say through job promotions or a class, you know, a grade in a class. And so a lot of times we're faced with that decision of, okay, do I engage in this behavior? Even though there's a risk of embarrassment, there's a risk of a negative experience, but there's also the potential for reward. And how do I respond to that situation? Mm-hmm. There are also times with, for example, I'm trying to think of a really good example of generalized anxiety disorder. And I think I can come up with one, but if Hannah and Elizabeth have a really good example they'd want to share, I'd like to bring them into.
Sure. What characterizes generalized anxiety disorder is a broad array of worries, right? Worry that kind of encompasses anything and everything that's happening in the person's life. So what we're looking for is what kinds of behaviors is that person avoiding related to that generalized anxiety and worry? So for example, one thing that they might be avoiding is maybe they're worrying about their finances. Maybe something they need to do is sit down, go through bills, and make a budget. And that's something that maybe they've been putting off for a long time. You can imagine that contributing to this vicious cycle. The worry increases because they've been ignoring it. There's more to worry about. And so that decision is a great example of that kind of motivational conflict or that approach avoidance conflict, because there's lots of reasons to approach that behavior, right? Mm-hmm. It might be really helpful in the long term to pay those bills, figure out that budget. There could be right peace of mind, right? Having a better grip on your finances, all those great things in the future that would be a reason to do that. And yet there's also lots of reasons to avoid for that person. Maybe sitting down and doing it is going to bring up lots of negative emotions. Maybe they're going to discover bills that they forgot about. So it's, you know, realizing that there's more to the problem than they thought. And so in that moment when they're considering engaging in this behavior, mm-hmm. those two motivations are conflicting.
So they ultimately are paralyzed by their own predictors of what's going to happen or what could happen. Does that sound?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Do you find that people in those scenarios, I mean, that's a pretty common scenario, I would imagine. Do you find that most people, if they can take the first step and just sit down and make the budget, that anxiety is relieved more quickly?
I think that first step is really difficult, especially when we've become stuck in that habit of avoiding. But we also see that not only is the first step difficult, continuing to follow through is difficult. And so, you know, we're not working with people just on like, oh, just take that first step and your anxiety is going to fizzle away. But it's also, how do we maintain this change in the long term? Mm-hmm. Because those habits are going to continually come back and try to pull you back in. So the more we repeat these processes, that's what helps those anxieties dissipate over time.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
I would add, to kind of piggyback off of that, something that I try to remind myself as to try to be a good behavioral therapist is that a lot of what we're kind of working on with our patients is, you know, we're not teaching them rocket science. Oftentimes we're telling them things that we kind of already know, you know, by you avoiding this, the anxiety is building over time. It would be really good for you if you could engage in it and kind of get back into things. Mm-hmm. This usually isn't a huge revelation. These are things they already know. So a lot of what we're providing is just the scaffolding for that. They're putting in the effort of coming in every week. We are providing reminders of why it's important. We're providing enormous amounts of encouragement when they do the really hard things. We're kind of drawing their attention towards, okay, so let's talk about what was hard about that. Let's talk about what the consequences were of that. Isn't it nice that you don't have this on your plate anymore? So just providing a lot of the scaffolding rather than, you know, pretending that we're teaching people something that they don't already know, because very often they do.
Sure. So a lot of our listeners are professionals, but many of them aren't. Can you talk about what behavioral therapy is as opposed to other types of therapy?
Yeah, I can jump in on that. So when we think about, you know, this is from a cognitive behavioral perspective. So the idea is that, you know, we have our thoughts, we have our feelings, we have our behaviors, and all of these things are very related and dynamically relate to one another. So, you know, our emotions and our thoughts often do contribute to our behaviors, but then when we behave in certain ways, there's consequences or there's things that happen as a result of that behavior that in turn modify the way we feel and modify the way we think about things. And so the idea is that you can intervene at different points of that CBT triangle of the cognitions, behaviors, and the emotions to influence outcomes and how people are doing in their lives. So behavior therapy is really focused on modifying the behaviors so that then their experiences are different. So that then that circles back around to not only hopefully lead to continued behavior change, but also leads to modifications in the way their thought processes are, and then hopefully their emotions as well. And, you know, everybody can jump in and provide maybe examples of this, but, you know, if we jump off the example with the bills, for, you know, that someone might be going in with this fear that, oh my goodness, if I look at all of this financial information, I'm going to find out that I'm basically going bankrupt, or that I'm not going to be able to afford rent the next month, or I'm just not going to be able to handle it. And I'm going to be so stressed out the rest of the day, I'm not going to be able to engage in the rest of my work. But if they do engage in that behavior, what they might actually find is, oh, I'm not actually doing as bad as I thought I was. I am going to be able to afford rent the next month. I can identify places where I can maybe cut back my spending to help me going forward. And then that's a rewarding behavior. So there can be a building of self-efficacy and confidence in, okay, I can do this. And so it changes that thought pattern a little bit, as well as changes maybe their thoughts and emotions about their financial situation that then influences their behavior and thoughts and everything else going forward too. Sure. But Hannah and Elizabeth, you want to jump in on more info or definitions?
Well, I think that's a great definition. One thing I would add. So generally, you know, in practice, in the wild, cognitive behavioral therapists will apply a mix of behavioral techniques and cognitive techniques. Behavioral techniques being, let's focus on this behavior. Let's look at how we can change it. What would it take for you to do something different? All those things. Mm-hmm. And the cognitive techniques being more like, let's examine your thoughts. Let's apply some critical reasoning and questioning to some of these thoughts. What are the thoughts that you tend to have that are really making your mood worse? What are the thoughts that pop in your mind that make your anxiety worse? And so usually in the wild, therapists are applying a mix of cognitive and behavioral techniques under that umbrella of cognitive behavioral therapy. In our research, because we're really interested in isolating the effects of just the behavioral interventions alone, we're doing something kind of unusual, which is applying behavioral techniques only. Uh-huh. We do not do any of what's known as cognitive restructuring, Socratic questioning, these kinds of clinical techniques that go at the cognitive side of things or the thoughts. Mm-hmm. And something that's really striking in some of the findings is with behavioral techniques only, when therapists are prohibited from using any cognitive techniques, just going after behaviors, it still is pretty effective. We saw some really impressive results.
Oh, wow. Okay. As Robin was talking and as you expanded on, I was just thinking you'd almost have to have both. You'd almost have to apply both for it to be effective. But it sounds like that may not be the case. So that's exciting.
Yeah. And just to add it, not, you know, beyond our research, in particular with behavioral activation, there's been dismantling studies comparing behavioral activation alone compared mm-hmm. to behavioral activation with the cognitive restructuring. And behavioral activation has been just as effective. And in fact, there's been one study that compared like behavioral activation alone, cognitive approaches, and medication. And what they found is actually for severe depression, behavioral activation did similar to medications, and both were superior to cognitive approaches with severe depression. So there's some indication, at least with depression, that in some ways these simpler approaches may actually be more effective, where you're just aiming to modify these very straightforward, concrete behaviors versus cognitive restructuring, which can be sometimes, I think, harder for people that are experiencing really severe depression to engage effectively.
So what drove you to enter this field, into particularly this research path?
Elizabeth, I'll let you go first since.
I don't feel like I always have a straightforward answer like, oh, it was this thing. I think my life experiences really navigated me here. And for me, one thing that has always been really important, I started at Liber as a research assistant and got my master's in mental health counseling while I was working here. So from the beginning, I was really driven to give back to my community. And I felt that LIBOR is a very unique place for us to have in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the work we do here is amazing. So continuing on to become an LPC, I was able to work face-to-face and really see that change in the people in my community. So for me, being able to contribute to the research side of things, but also watching change happen individually in my participants and clients is really what drove me down this path and what keeps me here.
Sure. How about you, Hannah?
So I would say my kind of journey into psychology started from just an interest in human emotion and emotional experience. I learned about the career of being a therapist, and that was really interesting to me. It's something that I wanted to be able to do to help people. And then I learned that there was this other side of psychology where you could do science to understand human emotion. And I thought that was just so cool. So that led me down the PhD route and into research. And the more that I studied human emotion, and in particular, one of the ways that emotion can most drastically affect people's lives is in the experience of clinical anxiety and mental illness more generally, that really led me in towards a more specific path of understanding the brain to understand behavior. Mm-hmm. Because of what we've been talking about, the way that our behavior has this really close-knit two-way relationship with the way we feel. Mm-hmm. The way we feel impacts what we do, and everything we do impacts how we feel. That really, to me, seemed like a really interesting and important way to look under the hood and understand the human experience is understanding how does the brain generate behavior. So that landed me where I'm at now, as working as a therapist, working one-on-one with people in groups to try to help people navigate their experiences. And also in the neuroscientist side of things, kind of looking under the hood to try to understand how these things come about.
Sure. How about you, Robin?
Well, I think just being here, I think there's a combination of like experiences that led me here, and then also a combination of skills that I enjoyed engaging in that also combined into that. So on the skill side, you know, just to make it brief, I went through evolution of wanting to go to med school, but also being a math major at one point, and then very much enjoying writing. And so you put quantitative stuff, wanting to help people in like writing together, and research in psychology can fits the bill with those things. But also I think in college, I really decided, as opposed to the medical route, which my older sister went into, I wanted to spend more time with people and less time billing or thinking about prescriptions. Mm-hmm. And so that led me into the psychology route. I really wanted to be a clinician, but I decided to go the PhD route and knew that I would need to do research to get my PhD, but kind of saw it as like this pesky little side project I'd have to do to get to the PhD in clinical psychology. But when I was a first year graduate student, I think one of the first functional MRI studies was published looking at the impact of cognitive behavioral therapy on brain activations. Mm-hmm. And it was focused on spider phobia. So, you know, very focal, very focused, but it very much opened my eyes to, oh, I could combine my love of therapy and of helping people, but also actually understanding how it's working and what's happening. And with the idea that therapy can have just as powerful an effect on the brain as medication. And even though now that seems pretty obvious, I think, to most of us that, you know, you change the way people are thinking and behaving, and that's going to have an impact on the brain that's doing all of those things. I think at the time it felt like a rather revolutionary change in the thinking of what are the impacts of the different interventions. And so I was lucky enough to be in Kansas City. I was going to University of Kansas, and they had a brain imaging center open up right around that time as well. And there was a researcher there, Carrie Savage, focused on anxiety disorders and OCD and brain imaging. And it all kind of just coalesced and came together. And I absolutely fell in love with the research side.
I love that. Has there been anything, I'm sure that there has, this is almost a silly question, but it's more curiosity than anything else, throughout your research careers, and this question is for whomever of you wants to answer it, but throughout your research careers, has anything surprised you? Meaning you anticipated one, yeah, you anticipated something and were, you know, something completely different.
I will jump in and say that, like, we hear the research and we hear, yes, this is where this works, this is why it works. But personally, for me, seeing it happen, taking someone from session one to session 10 and seeing not just the change they expected, but change above and beyond that was and continues to be just a piece that I'm like amazed by every time. I'm like, I know these therapies work, but it is just so cool and rewarding to see it work from a therapist perspective and to see that change in your client's life.
So to that end, I mean, I'm sure as in any profession, there are best practices. There are, okay, these are the tools that I know they're effective because research says that they are. Suppose you have a patient or a client and you are implementing these tools and the two of you together are discovering that they are not as effective as the two of you would like them to be. Is there room to pivot? Do you have backup in your back pocket? How would you navigate that?
It's a really great question because, like Hannah said, in the wild, yes, as a therapist, we would have room to pivot and use the knowledge we've gathered from our client, kind of what they want to bolster what we're doing. In our research studies, we don't really have as much room to pivot. There's always troubleshooting we can do, working with the client to say, hey, what is working for you? What's not working for you? And going back to, okay, how can we make this very structured therapy work for you? And on the same hand, that's part of what we're looking at. Like when clients come in and the therapy might not be working for them, we do encourage them to stick with the research so we can learn more about what's working, what might not be working for certain people.
Yeah. And to kind of bounce off of that, I was kind of thinking about my answer to things that have surprised me. And one of them is definitely in a research study when you have a patient that maybe comes in, they don't seem to be liking the therapy, maybe even from the little description we give them at the beginning, they already have formed an opinion of this is not the one that I wanted. You know, why did you guys put me in this one? And of course, they're randomized in. So that, you know, that sometimes is just luck of the draw. And it's sometimes really rewarding and cool to see that in a situation where, you know, in the wild, we might think this patient doesn't seem like a great match for this therapy, I'll switch away. Right. In a research setting, we say this patient might not be a great match for this therapy, but we're going to stay the course and see what happens. Right. As long as it doesn't seem to be harming the patient, we're going to keep going. Right. Sometimes what we find out is by session 5 or session 6, the patient's getting better. And so that's been, I think, really cool to see that, you know, this is why we do this kind of clinical research, because our clinical intuition, as much as we'd like it to be always correct and spot on, sometimes is not spot on. We can't always predict how a person is going to do based on how we feel as therapists or based on how they're feeling at the beginning of the therapy. So that's been a really pleasant surprise to see, you know, if someone is kind of struggling with the fit at the beginning, by staying the course and by doing the things that don't come naturally to them, sometimes that actually can be a sign that this really is the therapy that's going to help you because it's so difficult.
I think this is kind of related to what Hannah and Elizabeth have talked about, but I think as I was getting into this field in terms of clinical outcomes research, I think a lot of times you see the studies and you're like, oh, this therapy works for this. And so then when it doesn't work with a client, you're like, I must be doing something wrong. Like, I'm not a good therapist. Like, this isn't working as well as it should be based on what these studies say. And then realizing like what's not shown usually in what we like to show in our presentations is the clinical outcome graphs that are nice and beautiful and average across everybody and show this great symptom decrease. And then also showing the plots that show everyone's data individually and just how variable that those outcomes are that then we do experience when we're actually treating people on an everyday basis, that not everyone responds to these interventions as well as what we would like them to. And in fact, it's, you know, even on the high side, we would say probably 60% of folks actually experience long-term lasting benefits from even our gold standard interventions. And that's another motivation for the work that we're doing is trying to understand that, like, why might some people not be responding as well? Are there specific interventions and ways to match an intervention to a person that we could increase the likelihood of outcomes? Like Hannah said, I think a lot of times as therapists or as clients, like, we think we know what might be best or what we prefer. but that's not always right on. Like sometimes our gut instinct isn't necessarily correct every time either. And so really this kind of motivation to try to better understand that so we could do better in the future. And I think there's little things in terms of brain findings and such that are surprising, but I think perhaps like less obviously surprising in terms of directionality of how prefrontal cortex activations relate to outcomes and things like that.
Sure. I love that when you say 60% may respond, which tells me 40% are not responding as one would hope, that is a motivator to explore that rather than defeating
them. Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Do any of you have anything else you'd like to share with our listeners before we wrap this up?
Can't think of anything. Yeah, Elizabeth, thanks for doing this. It's a great idea.
Yeah, thank you guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
All right.
Bye-bye. 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 I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Robert Opperle, Ms. Elizabeth Eggman, and Dr. Hannah Berg. For more on the work they are involved in at Laureate Institute for Brain Research, visit www.laureateinstitute.org. Thank you for listening to the Mental Health Download.